Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, reporting from the front lines of the invasion of Ukraine, we discuss the Pulitzer Prize-winning film documenting Russia's brutal siege of the city of Mariupol and war crimes against its residents. Later in the program, how to keep families in crisis from falling apart. But first, 20 Days in Mariupol offers an unprecedented and unflinching look at the 2022 siege of that city by Russian forces. The documentary screens at WJCT Studios on Thursday, and here to discuss it, we welcome award-winning journalist and former Moscow bureau chief for Newsweek, Andrew Nagorsky. He's most recently the author of Saving Freud, The Rescuers Who Brought Him to Freedom. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
Thank you, Ann.
We're also joined by local World Affairs Council president and CEO, Trina Medrev. The group is hosting the screening, along with WJCT Public Media, and we're also joined by station CEO and president, David McGowan. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Great to be here.
So, David, this film crew captured some of the most defining images of the war from this besieged city of Mariupol, some of the ones that we remember collectively. It was created by AP journalists who were on the front lines, eventually kind of behind the front lines, but it was edited and produced as a frontline documentary for PBS. And even in the world of frontline work, it really is an exceptional documentary film.
It is, and I want to take the opportunity to really give a shout out to Frontline, which has been just such an important force in investigative journalism and documentary filmmaking now for 40 years. You know, we used to have things on our airwaves like NBC White Papers and CBS Reports, right, where the networks would devote substantial resources and airtime to hour-long, in-depth documentary work. And really, Frontline is now the standard bearer, the lone standard bearer for that work. It has an unbelievable record of delivering prize-winning films to the public, available free for everyone to watch. Over 100 Emmy Awards, dozens of Peabody Awards, and now for the first time with this film, an Academy Award. And so that really is an opportunity for us to kind of shine a light on this incredible body of work and this particular film, and to work with our friends and partners at the World Affairs Council, who do so much great work here in Jacksonville and our region, in bringing these kind of world affairs in front of us. And we thought this would just be a great opportunity to share a film on the big screen that is just so powerful. Anyone who has watched it, I think, is moved by it. As you say, an AP team, Mislav Chernov and his small team, who were really trying to figure out how to get their day-to-day news footage out and into the world while communications were turned off and everything, were able to work with the frontline team and turn this into a really compelling documentary that I think we'd have to say gives viewers a kind of an unprecedented look at what it feels like to be an ordinary citizen caught up in on the front lines of a harrowing invasion. It is really something.
Trina, as he said, this won an Academy Award. It also won a Pulitzer for public service journalism. What about this film aligns with the World Affairs Council kind of goals and missions? And why did you decide to co-sponsor this?
Well, first of all, this tremendous partnership with WJCT, bringing the world closer to our community and delivering the stories behind today's headlines. And this is what we do here in Jacksonville, and other chapters of the World Affairs Councils across the U.S. also do this good work. But when David McGowan had reached out with this opportunity, we knew that it was an evening we would want to host in partnership and make available to our council members, in addition to the community at large.
So, Andrew, you spent more than 3 decades as a foreign correspondent and editor for Newsweek, working around the world. But you, in your early career, you covered Russia from Moscow. What strikes you about this film? Are there familiar elements, even today, from what you experienced?
Oh, yes, they're very familiar elements. I think what's striking, I'll just echo what David said. This is an extraordinary film. It brings you right up. I think anybody who is questioning why are Ukrainians fighting and so hard to and trying to keep their country independent, if you see this film, you can't but say, this is why. This is, and what comes across, the constant element. I started as a correspondent in the Soviet era in the early 80s. I was back there in the 90s for a while. I had been expelled and was out of the country for several years. And then I was coming back in and out in the 90s and the early 2000s. It's one thread that is always there, unfortunately, is the callous destruction of human life. And the degree to which, particularly now, the Putin regime does that on a daily basis. It does that in its invasion of Ukraine and its continuing assault on civilian targets, the kinds of things you see in that film, like the maternity hospital and that chilling footage. But it's that no price is too high as far as the regime is concerned to keep themselves in power, to keep their image of the strong men, while at the same time, Putin and his entourage are making sure that they keep themselves safe. I mean, those of you who may remember some of the COVID pictures of Putin, here he was during COVID. If he met with anyone at all, first of all, there was a whole disinfectant routine for that person who was coming in. And then he'd be sitting at a table about 9 feet across from somebody and protect the sacred ruler. While everybody else is expendable, it's not just Ukrainians who are dying in this war, but is Russian conscripts who are just thrown into this en masse. And even more Russians have died, soldiers, than Ukrainian soldiers, because they're so ill-prepared. And that's a theme in Russian history as well, in World War II and other conflicts. And all of this is playing itself out again.
And you mentioned just briefly that you were expelled. That was for your reporting.
Yes.
Explain how that, first of all, what your experience was and how that continues today in terms of the pressures that the government there puts on reporters.
When I was there, it was the late Brezhnev era, 81, 82. And you could operate as an American or any Western correspondent. You had accreditation. But they were trying to make sure that you did as little as possible real reporting. They wanted you to sort of regurgitate the official versions of events coming from TASS, news agencies, and official speeches. But when you went out and traveled and spoke to ordinary Russians, that's when the KGB surveillance got really intense. You knew that, for instance, the Newsweek apartment had been the Newsweek apartment for any number of correspondents. We knew everything was bugged. The office, the same thing. Our license plate said K for correspondent, O4 for American. It was like a billboard for anyone to follow. So you had to work around that. And I was expelled for the simple reason is I tried to report anyway. And did not, I was conscious of the fact the greatest risk was from my Russian sources or Russian or any Soviet sources, who many people wanted to contact me, to talk to me and tell me what was really happening. They were the ones who were the greatest risk. In my era there, you knew probably the greatest risk for yourself is what happened to me is you got expelled. You didn't want that to happen, but you could that was hardly the same thing as being sent off to prison or a psychiatric ward or the gulag. So you had to go there with that mentality that you're going to report as vigorously as possible. And you got various signals that they were unhappy with that. They actually slashed my tires on one occasion. The tailing became much more overt. And, they could do it covertly, but overtly they were sending a signal to anyone who was coming approaching me that this is a dangerous person, and they were trying to intimidate people trying to contact me and trying to prevent me from going out myself. So that was a constant. So I was expelled after 14 months in what was then the Soviet Union. I was out of the country for about 7 years before I could get back in. Then things were loosening up some. There was glasnost, perestroika, the Gorbachev era, then the Yeltsin era. And I started going back in, and I was again there in the mid-90s, which was a chaotic period. Boris Yeltsin was the leader. there was a lot of crime, there was a lot of corruption, but there were elections, there was a vibrant media, and Western reporters like myself could interview all sorts of people and on the record that we never had been able to interview before. So there was a sense maybe Russia will develop into a normal country. It's an amazing country, many talented people. We had a wonderful time when we lived in Russia, even in the Soviet era, in terms of the personal contacts, the great artists, great musicians. But then when Putin comes to power, things begin to change very quickly, and the intimidation increases gradually at first, and now it is more dangerous, more repressive than it even was when I was there the first time.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing the documentary 20 Days in Mariupol, which screens for free Thursday here at WJCT Studios. You can join our conversation on air at 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out via Facebook or Instagram. You know, the difficulty of wartime reporting is really almost impossible to imagine. This crew is very peripheral in its own documentary. And when it does come into play, it really is talking about its efforts to get its content out. And the urgency of that mission is palpable, and really so is the danger.
The front line is closing in. We've sent all the photos and videos, note to editors, graphic content. This is painful. This is painful to watch. But it must be painful to watch.
In the port city of Mariupol, local officials say hundreds of casualties are now feared.
A father lost in grief over the body of his 16-year-old son, Ilya.
The electricity is gone. The internet's gone. The Russians are coming. Mariupol awaits its fate.
Andrew, I want to ask you about that because the circumstances are obviously different, but in some ways, the work of a foreign correspondent is urgent in the way of trying to get that information out, trying to find a source or an outlet that will share that information, because you know on the ground what you're covering is really essential to that country's fate or that region's, you know, issues. And yet it's not always easy to find somewhere in the States that is going to put all of their resources into broadcasting that.
Well, of course. I mean, that's part of the question we face, and which David pointed out earlier, that there used to be, it seemed, more outlets for serious reporting, serious in-depth kind of, whether it's video or audio or print. And there are still outlets, but you often feel overwhelmed by the trivia out there too that seems to drown out a lot of the serious issues. And I think it makes people sort of feel like it's almost, you know, a mini series. And now I'm bored with this story, let's go on to the next one. But these people are living this story. These people are trying to survive. Their country is trying to survive as a country, and that should always come through. And that's why I'm particularly glad that there's going to be this screening here of this film, because I think, as I mentioned, it's something that will really make people see it. And there's a raw quality to this, and the courage also. And your point about, it's not only that this crew had to get their message out and find a place to then have it distributed, they had to survive. They were taking huge risks. They were there when the shelling was taking place. You never know in those situations where the next shell is going to come. And then sometimes you can suddenly find yourself literally behind enemy lines.
David, this crew was, we should say, the only international reporting crew that was in Mariupol when this was happening. And so the only information that the world was getting about what was happening there was coming from this crew in little bits and pieces when they could find an internet connection, and, you know, sending small clips. But these are the moments, and I think we all remember when the maternity ward bombing images first surfaced, just how striking and horrifying those were. But the filmmaker says, you know, he himself was skeptical about the impact that some of these images would have. He'd covered so many conflicts.
Yeah, it's really hard to know, I think, when you're in it, right? What it feels like on the outside to see these images. And as you say, you know, when you're here as a television viewer and watching the news and you see some of these images, one of the things that I loved about this film was that you really understand the whole story of those 3 weeks and what was happening. And you're not just getting a 30-second clip or a bite. You're actually understanding what it took to get that picture out. The other thing that I think is really striking about the film, and it really speaks to the era that we're in, is that because we live in a time in which really almost any picture can be faked on the internet, when reporters in the film actually confront various Russian officials at various times, they actually just deny that any of this is happening, in spite of the fact that the world is watching it. And that's just really an incredible thing to think about, because you can have a situation in which, you know, you're looking at a picture, you're looking at a piece of video footage and say, actually, that never happened. I mean, that's just completely fake. And there's a group of people in the world who are inclined to believe that and then spread that message itself. And, you know, we always talk about how in war, information is the first casualty. And that's clearly also evident in this film. All of the people in Mariupol are desperate for information the first few days, right? They're just trying to figure out what in the world is actually happening to their city. But this is a whole new, to me, it felt like this is really a symbol of the modern era, that, you know, you can risk your life, to literally risk your life and that of your colleagues, to get something on camera, deliver it to the world, and then there's someone who can just say, yeah, that never happened.
That's, I mean, they went beyond. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's the technology is much more sophisticated now, for better and worse, in terms of falsification. But that's another constant from the Soviet era. You know, I sometimes, when I speak to particularly young journalists or students, say, who was the father of Photoshop? Joseph Stalin. He would take photos. There would be photos of the Politburo, and then the people he would purge suddenly would disappear from those photos. This was long before you could Photoshop, but they had technicians in the Soviet Union who could do that. And it's the same thing when you see that Russian, I think, ambassador who's in that video in the film saying, "Oh no, these are actors, and these are staged scenes," and that fills the Russian internet right now and Russian state TV, and people, when they hear that day after day, some believe.
Sure.
Although I do have to say, don't believe when they say everybody in Russia believes this stuff. Every opportunity there has been to protest in some way, people have taken extraordinary risks. It's now an extraordinary risk to put down some flowers to memorialize Navalny or whoever was most recently assassinated or imprisoned. And so there is courage in that society, but it is so violently suppressed that you have to just really recognize the people who have that courage and are willing to still demonstrate it.
And communications played such an important part in this story on so many different levels. You know, the speed in which the Russians came in and took out the defense systems and then went for communication systems. And so basically there was no way to communicate except from hearing from others on the ground. And there was a piece where people were lining up to charge their cell phones to be able to use as flashlights down in these basements. So it was very poignant, you know.
And because at that point the phones served no other purpose.
Right.
Because there's no communication.
There was no way to connect.
We have a call, Juliana, calling from St. John's. Good morning, Juliana. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you so much for taking my call. First, I just wanted to say this conversation is so, so important, and I really appreciate this and the screening that WJCT is doing and closing lived in Russia in 1985-86 and married someone there, and we were married for 5 years. And I have to reiterate that the Russian people as a whole are wonderful people.
Juliana, I think we lost your phone call there. But David, I mean, this screening really is an opportunity for people to see something that is a rarity in any world of film. I mean, there have been, Restrepo, there have been films about wartime in battle, but, you know, very often embedded, you know, and not right. with the people who are experiencing it. I mean, one thing that's really, you know, moving about this film is the film crew itself is uncertain and scared and fleeing, and they're very much a part of the people that they're covering because they're experiencing it.
Right, and they really don't have any more information than the people who they are surrounded by, the doctors in the hospitals, the people in their apartment buildings who are trying to figure out what's going on. They're trying to figure it out too. One scene that I think is particularly striking is when they go up to a higher floor in the hospital, really, which they know is actually quite dangerous, but they need to get a view, right? They need to be able to see out, to be able to see where the front line actually is. I just want to take 1 minute to mention one other thing in really related to what Andrew was saying about the risks of reporting, the difficulty of reporting. And I want to mention the name of Evan Gershovich, because I think it's important to all of us to remember that there is a young reporter for The Wall Street Journal who right now has been in prison, in Russian prison, for over a year, who is accused essentially of being a spy. And I think no one thinks that he actually is a spy. And I just say that because it's so, you know, as time goes on, it's very easy to have these people recede into the background of our collective consciousness. And I think it's important, if we care about journalism and we appreciate the risks that journalists take every single day, it's just important to keep them in the forefront of our thinking. So I just wanted to mention his name.
That's a good point. And Andrew, I mean, the work of a journalist very often is the kind of thing that would raise suspicions for somebody that is a particularly repressive government. I mean, you're going out, you're trying to find sources, you're trying to find information, you know, the line between somebody that could be prosecuted in Russia or accused of spying and legitimate journalism is perhaps porous enough that they're, you know, build a case like this, in their eyes, it is, you know, espionage.
Well, in their eyes, you're always, if you want to see a journalist as a spy, you always can. And there's, you know, I knew, for instance, that when I was called in to be expelled, and I asked them why, I almost expected them to say, you're a spy. They didn't. In the end, they made a whole bunch of ridiculous accusations about where I'd gone and without permission, or I had impersonated a Polish tourist because I spoke Polish, or that I, you know, just very silly things. You know that they can always throw that spy thing out because a journalist asks questions, as you say, tries to gather information. What do spies do? Well, in theory, they do similar things, but for different purposes. And it's also because in Russia, traditionally, or the Soviet Union earlier, there was no line for many Soviet journalists. They had to respond. They were considered government employees, whether they were formerly KGB or not, didn't matter. They had to. There was no distinction between what they were doing in terms of the quote journalism part and what their role was. So immediately they project that onto you. I'll just give you one example. When I first came to the Soviet Union in 1981, I get called in. I had a meeting with some editors from Novosti, the news agency. It was just a courtesy visit. And at that one point, I was meeting with about three editors there. And one of them says to me, well, Mr. Nagorsky, we know that you take your orders from the State Department every week as to what to report for Newsweek. I said, oh, you know? So what am I going to say? If I deny it, then it's my cover. If I say, yeah, it's just fruitless to almost respond to that. But I'm glad you mentioned Evan. Or Evan Gershkovich, I mean, it's clear he was a young reporter doing his job. And it's also important why they went after Evan in particular. I think he's a good Russian speaker. They always hated it. The more you knew, the more versed you were in the language, the culture, the more they wanted to get rid of you. And then they obviously, in this case, they're using him as a pawn. They want it's there's nothing secretive about it. You know, you're going to trade for maybe a real Russian spy or something else. You're going to get something out of it. So he was unfortunately caught in that trap.
We've got a call, John, from Riverside. John, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say about the faked images or Stalin and photoshopping. If you see a faked image, it doesn't matter whether or not you know it's faked. If I show a picture of you killing a puppy, a movie of you killing a puppy that's been faked, you're going to have an emotional reaction to that. When you remember, when your name comes up, it's going to be associated with that movie of you killing the puppy and the emotional reaction. You can kind of correct to say, well, I know that was fake, but that's the starting point where your brain works when dealing with you. You have to backtrack from you killing the puppy. So these images, despite the fact we may know these things have been faked, it's not really going to change the emotional reaction or their effect.
Right. Good point. I mean, to be clear, the images in this film are not faked. The filmmaker that was, you know, dealing when Russian tanks were rolling in, as they began surrounding the hospital where they were at and realizing that there was no escape, he starts to think about, you know, what his options are, again, trying to get this information out to his editors.
What should we do? We need to send all this footage. Survivors from the maternity bombing. Tanks shooting at residential areas. There is no connection here, and we can't get to our car. And if we get caught, Vladimir says, Russians will make you say everything you published was a lie.
So that's the concern there, David, is not just they can't get this information out, but if they're caught as press and their footage is confiscated, they'll be imprisoned. They'll be forced to renounce everything that they've shot and say that it was faked. And so it's not just, you know, the footage that they need to get out, but their own safety is a matter of kind of preserving the integrity of the work that they've done.
Yeah, I think as that scene that just rolled demonstrates, one of the really compelling things about the film is that the filmmakers take you inside their own dilemma. They're not pretending in this film to know what they should do in any given situation, right? He says, oh, you know, what should we do? We can't get to our car. We've got no way of getting this footage out. We hear that the troops are going to arrive. You know, what should we do? And you are, as a viewer, you are right in that moment. I mean, I can't tell you how gripping and harrowing that moment is. And if you permit me, I just want to also just say that about the screening, that this is such a great example of the work that the World Affairs Council does here and that WJCT Public Media does here in this place. Yes, this is a film that is, you know, was distributed by Frontline nationally that we broadcast as a PBS broadcaster. But making these experiences happen here for our community, enriching them with some context and a local speaker, this is really what the World Affairs Council is all about, why it is such a treasure here. We have a long history now of bringing filmmakers. We brought Michael Kirk, a award-winning Frontline filmmaker, here for a special event quite recently to talk about his work and the work he's done for Frontline, again, to a local audience live in person. This screening is going to happen on the big screen here. It is going to be really something to see. It's available. You go on our website at wjct.org, and you can see, or wjct.org/events, but you'll see a button to push to register. It's free. I would not recommend it for children, I have to say, but we welcome everyone. And I know the World Affairs Council and Trina have been such great partners, and I know they join us in welcoming everyone.
And you have a special host, too, that's going to be at that event, J.P. Natkin.
J.P. Natkin, that's correct.
kind of a Eurasian
expert.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to be providing some context for the film in addition to just the screening. So there'll be an opportunity to kind of ask some questions.
Correct, correct. And get some grounding before we delve into the documentary.
You know,
just like Andrew was here today to provide some grounding as well.
One element that is interesting about the film is that even when the filmmakers themselves have some skepticism about the impact that their work could possibly have on this conflict and the world's view of this conflict, there are people inside the film that are really passionate in their belief that what is happening on that film is a story that needs to be told. You know, there's a doctor when they're shooting in a hospital and telling them, you know, get this footage. There's a child, you know, dead, dying on the table in front of them. You know, the world needs to see this. And in fact, the way that they escaped ultimately was a law enforcement agent that spoke directly to the camera, you know, making a direct appeal about, you know, what was happening and that this was, you know, the act of Vladimir Putin, the war that he'd created, wanting to get that out so that he actually takes them to a caravan to kind of help this film crew get out and get that out.
And that's something I encountered often in Russia or the Soviet Union in general, even in Soviet times. They say, if you tell this story, the world will know and something will change. Well, as we can see, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. But I think this film has such a powerful message, especially at the time when we're debating aid for Ukraine, debating what is at stake here. This film points that out, and I would hope that this will be a case where getting that message out and at such risk and at such with such dedication that it will pay off.
And telling those fuller stories, as you said, David, we've seen clips. You may think you kind of know some of this story, but what you don't realize is that this film backs up and it takes the character that you may have seen a soundbite of, the full picture of what happened. Sometimes he's tracking people, you know, from hospital to hospital to see what happened to them, following up on their story. One young child who's ended up dying had a terrible injury. And later on in the show, he recognizes the bloody blanket that he's under, you know, as he's being
right.
buried in a mass grave. So there is like this continuity that tells a much fuller story.
No, it does. And I mean, it's a really compelling, as I said, it's really a compelling, whatever it is, you know, 90-minute film. It feels like a film, not like a collection of bites or sound bites or sort of news footage. It's a story, and it unfolds over 20 days, day by day. And it is harrowing and full of the kind of drama that you would expect. In that kind of a situation where people are literally under siege and trying to figure out what's going on, what to do.
I think it's important to say, as difficult as this film is to watch, it's not a film that you regret having seen. It really is a film that is empowering to have seen, and it's a beautifully shot film. It really is a rewarding experience. So it's not as hard as it is to watch. It's actually very, you know, I would encourage people to see it.
Yeah, and I would just reinforce the message that it tells the admiration for the people who are trying to preserve their country and for the Russians who have protested this war and who have paid in many cases with their lives. You know, so it is, I've known any number of Russian politicians, parliamentarians, journalists who have lost their lives in opposing the policies of Vladimir Putin.
Well, the free screening of the documentary 20 Days in Mariupol is held here at WJCT Studios on Thursday, April 18th. It starts at 6:30, and you can reserve a seat at wjct.org/events. Andrew Nagorski, Trina Medrev, David McGowan, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, how to help families experiencing hardship find a path to reunification. Welcome back. Job loss, incarceration, substance abuse, they can all create toxic stress in any household. But when kids are involved, that stress can lead to neglect or even abuse. I'm joined now by two people who say job assistance can help prevent state intervention or even child removal. Erica DeLeon, Chief of Staff for Better Together, an organization dedicated to helping people find employment, hosting a Second Chances job fair this week. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you for having me.
And Eric Linton, president of T&M Electric and one of the companies that will be at the job fair hiring.
Hey, correct. Yeah.
Nice to have you. So,
you.
Erica, who is this job fair for?
It is for the community. You know, second chance, April is Second Chance Month, and we all need a second chance. And the community is filled with families that have gaps in resumes, may have a history of, incarceration, just challenges that create barriers to employment. And Second Chances is all about opening opportunities and partnering with the community and employers and churches to bring communities to those families. Like I said, all of us need a second chance. I've been in that seat, and I'm incredibly grateful for the second chances provided to me. And so we're excited this week to be able to bring those opportunities to the community.
Are you comfortable sharing a little bit about your story, your experience personally?
Yeah, of course. So our mission at Better Together, just to kind of give some context, is to really wrap around families and walk alongside them and help them navigate their crisis. And that could be homelessness. It could be job loss, a multitude of reasons. And you know, I come from humble beginnings, and I'm incredibly grateful. I had a teen mom who really didn't have a whole lot of opportunities, and so we experienced homelessness. And living through those situations in early childhood, just I saw quite a bit. And I remember the day that she got her first job. She didn't have any work experience, and when she stepped into that employment, just the fulfillment, and it made her whole, it gave her meaning, and it gave her purpose. And to see the families that we serve in the community find their own purpose and meaning through work, and knowing what it feels to have that extended to them. Myself, I was a child in a home that experienced that. So I'm just excited and encouraged to be a part of this week.
Eric, what is it that you, why do you participate in this? And what is it that you've, why would you offer, positions to people who need a second chance, who may have a troubled resume? What is your motivation for that?
Thank you. Great question. And I too, have been afforded many second chances in life. I dare to say today that I would not be here with you if it weren't for people extending me second opportunities. So there's a lot of reasons we partner with Second Chances, but probably the dearest to my heart is I have been afforded second chances. It reminds me in my life of a Bible verse in Book of Jonah, chapter 3 and verse 1, that says the word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time. Jonah got a second opportunity in life. And if you know a little bit about that story, you'll see that he took that opportunity and spread a message that radically changed an entire city. And if he was not afforded that second opportunity, it may have not worked out that way.
Why do you think some employers are reluctant to give second chances when somebody's got a gap in the resume or if they've been incarcerated? They see it as a risk?
Yeah, I think that today it seems our culture defines people by their last mistake in life. And in doing so, that somewhat ties people's hands to extend those opportunities. We have many successful cases at work where people have been incarcerated, given those second opportunities, and have just expanded on them and done great work through those second opportunities.
What are some of the challenges that they face when they're coming to a workplace and need a second chance? Do you have to make special accommodations?
In some cases, yes. We are a company that does background checks, and we work on jobs that are sensitive to that. So there are some jobs that some candidates could be disqualified for. However, there are many other jobs that they would be qualified for. So we don't really, move the bar. But we do have situations and opportunities that we can use these candidates and you know, offer them the second chances that they so need.
And so, Erica, Better Together is a faith-based organization, but this is not limited to people of a certain faith. This job fair is open.
It is open to the community. Going back to what I said, we've all been there. We all have needed that second opportunity. And so this is an opportunity for everyone to show up. This is for you. This is for you all. This is for your communities. If there is a need, if it's coming in and getting, there'll be some volunteers available and ready to give job coaching, to support with resumes, to walk through some interview questions, whatever that need is, we're prepared to serve in that way.
And there's two job fairs. One is today, one is Thursday. Can you just tell us they're a little bit different in terms of the vendors and the services available?
Yes. Yeah, so today we will be at Northside Church of Christ from 11 to 2. And the concept is the same for both days. On Thursday, it's going to be at Garden View Baptist at 10 to 2. And there'll be, like I said, job coaches available on site. We'll have volunteers ready to just receive and just assess what the need is. There's going to be a multitude of employers that have partnered with us and are available to just be there, work with the community, do interviews, and just offer those opportunities.
And so what positions are you hiring for? I mean, and how many are you able to accommodate?
Almost all the positions are filled. Field related. We have many positions that are available, but primarily all field positions.
What is a field position?
Be electrician in the field, performing electrical work, conduit, wire, things of that nature. Just the construction side of the electrical.
Are there any success stories that you can share from the work that you've done in terms of offering those opportunities, Eric?
Absolutely. We currently have three or four candidates that are from the previous Second Chance Job Fair, and I think one of them has enrolled in our NEPA, it's our Northeast Florida Builders Association electrical class, and they are participating in that and certainly becoming a very valuable part of our team.
Well, Erica DeLeon, Eric Linton, thank you for the work that you're doing, and thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for the invite.
Stick around. We'll be back with an artist who brings her Florida backyard to life with oils and watercolor.
Ohio's Senate race could determine control of the U.S. Senate.
Republicans really feel that this is a seat that they can knock off. Democrats feel that Sherrod Brown speaks to not only their voters, but also can reach more moderate Republicans and voters who are independent.
I'm Anthony Brooks, Sherrod Brown versus Bernie Moreno, and what's at stake in Ohio. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Salman Rushdie talks about the knife attack while he was on stage. The doctors didn't expect him to survive. This was 33 years after Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa, a religious ruling calling for Rushdie's death as punishment for his book, The Satanic Verses. Rushdie's new book is called Knife. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
For a number of chain restaurants these days, opening new locations is a top priority.
I guess now's the time to grow, not shrink, you know, and especially since we didn't grow a lot during COVID. And so you have a lot of, you know, pent up growth ahead of us.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the art and science of fast food expansion. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The historic criminal trial of former President Donald Trump is underway in Manhattan.
These are felony crimes in New York State, no matter who you are.
Trump's pleaded not guilty. He claims the prosecutions are politically motivated. But how might this case and others shape future presidencies and our politics? The latest news from the courtroom, and we answer your questions next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Natural Florida's wildness and wilderness is the focus of Kathy Stark's art, and her latest exhibit hones in on the region's state and national parks. Welcome, Kathy.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm glad to have you. So how did you begin creating inspired by nature, generally speaking?
Well, I've always been an artist. I love being outside. And so when I go hiking, biking, dog walking, kayaking, canoeing, I'm always taking resource photos that I paint from.
Okay.
And I just love our area. I was born and raised here.
You work in both oil and watercolor.
I do,
which
yes.
I think of as being very different, but you've mastered them both, obviously.
I don't know about mastering them, but I really enjoy painting them, and I paint very large paintings. And more recently, I've been focusing on our landscapes from our parks and preserves.
Okay. And you have a number of posters that you brought. These are inspired by National Park Service posters that were created in the 30s under the Works Progress Administration. Tell us about those posters and why you decided to kind of emulate them or take an inspiration from them.
Well, I've always noticed them, and it was interesting with the New Deal. Franklin Roosevelt put artists back to work as well as other workers, and the style of these posters resonates with people. They resonate with me. Taking an iconic image of one of our national parks, our big national parks, and then the style of the typeface is so recognizable, and I've always been drawn to them, and I knew our parks were too small to be of interest to continue to do it, so I chose to do them myself.
And so for people who aren't able to see or immediately visualize, describe the look of them and the typeface that you're talking about.
Well, so the original posters were silk screens, and so they're kind of more of a graphic design, and they used about 8 or so different colors, but they didn't blend the colors, and they were printed in one color at a time. So with my posters, I tried to replicate that look and, you know, chose color schemes for each different park and kind of compressed images and used a little artistic license to create iconic images for our local parks.
And this, the font, I guess, is also sort of distinct and looks to the period.
Yeah, it was definitely a font that was invented, I guess, or designed for this National Park posters from the 30s. And I think when people see it, it's, you know, used today, but it definitely has its own look.
And so there's like 420 some odd national parks. How many posters did you create for the local parks?
Yeah, so I created 7 of our local parks, 4 National Park Service parks, 2 state parks, and then Seven Creeks Recreation Area is a combination of our national city and state parks. So, and I also did 3 different nonprofit posters that are related to that serve and protect and support our park system.
So listeners won't know they're spread out here on the floor, and they really are beautiful and colorful. You said that a couple of them are the most popular.
Well, it seems like Big Talbot is selling the best, and maybe next is Little Talbot. And I think that those parks are at the beach, and people visit them and have a special connection to them. So they're interested in having them in their home as a connection.
And how is this different from your usual artistic approach or the style that you employ?
Well, this is more of a graphic design, and I'm a fine artist and paint, you know, large scale watercolors and oil paintings, and it's just definitely a totally, you know, different look, but it was something that I knew I could do as an artist and just felt, you know, compelled to paint.
And how long have you been working on the project?
Oh, it's been maybe since designing them. It was definitely over a year or so before I actually painted them. And I will like to mention that I was supported by a grant from the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville and PNC Bank to help pay for my time painting these paintings.
Oh, that's great. You got an artist grant to do that?
Mm-hmm, I did.
Terrific.
Arts project.
So the work that is here is for sale on your site, but it's also on display. Where can people see the larger images?
Yes, they left Mosh, and they were there from about December to the end of March, and now they are at the Visitor Center at Fort Caroline National Memorial. And so they'll be there for 3 months. And kind of a little special plug is this coming Saturday, National Park Week starts. And so that runs from the 20th to the 27th. And then on World Migratory Bird Day, April 27th, I will be at the fort in the Visitor Center by my exhibit they're having a large event there. And it's kind of be a meet and greet kind of time for the artists, but there'll be other things related to that World Migratory Bird Day.
And I guess we should say that there is free entry on 420 to the national parks on that Saturday.
Well, to the ones that charge admission, like the big national parks. Our local national parks don't charge admission.
Oh, good to know. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Kathy Stark, thanks so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock, or you can find our entire archive at wjct.org and your favorite podcast platform. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our show is produced by Stacey Bennett and directed by Brady Corum. Our theme music is performed by Club de Belugas. Join us tomorrow when we discuss the latest tumult at JEA and the theme of the 54th Earth Day, the planet versus plastics. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.